I'm Demelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. As a veteran scenic designer, Carrie Wong made magic happen in 300 productions throughout the Northwest and beyond for more than 45 years. He got his start professionally in the 1980s as the resident set designer at Portland Opera for 8 seasons. Then he moved to Seattle, where he's designed for major theater and opera companies there, while still designing for Oregon Shakespeare Festival Portland, which would later become Portland Center Stage, and also at Oregon Children's Theater. Wong always kept a close relationship with Portland, where he grew up, and where his family owned a laundry business in Chinatown. Wong used to work summers there when he was in high school. At the time, it was a thriving community for Asian Americans. As the designer of the permanent exhibit Beyond the Gate at the Portland Chinatown Museum, which details the history of 2 Chinatowns that existed in Portland, he remains connected to this area. He now serves the museum as an art advisor. 16 of Wong's designs take center stage at the museum now in The World Transformed, an impressive retrospective of a master scenic designer. This exhibit is a walk through his growth as an artist, but also shows his influences and perspectives as one of the first BIPOC scenic designers in the performing arts in this area. I met up with Carrie Wong at the Portland Chinatown Museum, where he pointed out his family's laundry business just a few blocks away.
My grandparents had a laundry and dry cleaners called New China Laundry that was on Cooch between 2nd and 3rd. And I remember in high school, I actually worked there for my dad. Never work for your parents.
They're the worst bosses.
They are. Long hours, low pay.
No respect. even if you get paid. So how long was your grandparents' history with Chinatown?
Well, I know my dad actually grew up in Chinatown along with his generation. A lot of people who were founding board members of the Chinatown Museum also grew up in Chinatown, like Gloria Wong and Fred Lee and other people like that. But yeah, I mean, my dad was born in 1930. So he grew up, you know, kind of in the Chinatown area. And then, of course, they moved out of the Chinatown area to live. But the laundry still existed, I think, up until the 70s. And then it moved across the river to a different location. But yeah, I mean, I remember this area when I was growing up. It was kind of, you know, kind of down in the heels then. And it was kind of like the end of the Chinatown era in a way, as an active community, because people who were born and raised here, when they got successful or, you know, kind of earned more money, they moved out of the area. So that's what happened to our family.
Well, and this area too. I mean, it's so historic, and yet, I don't know, it doesn't seem like it has the attention from the city that it should. This museum, the Portland Chinatown Museum and the Japanese American Museum of Oregon, are like 2 shining beacons of history that is important to remember here, especially during May.
Well, and I think, you know, I think this area has kind of become an entertainment district, which is one way of revivifying the neighborhood and everything like that. But yeah, I do hope that the city pays more attention to this area so that it's possible for it to kind of improve.
So here we are at the start of The World Transformed, Scenic Designs by Carrie Wong. That must feel so good to see that title. But tell us about when you enter here. What is it important that people know about your work?
The introductory panel is intended to just give people an idea of how scale models figure into the whole process of developing scenic designs for the stage. And so it just tells a little bit about kind of what scale the models are and how they're used by various people in the production, from actors and directors to the shops and the scenic artists. And then it just kind of talks a little bit about people that I've worked with and also, you know, kind of how these pieces were chosen to include in the exhibit.
Let's go to the first model that you have here, because you have a series of 16 models in this exhibit.
Right. There are 16 models, and 6 of them are Asian or Asian-themed shows or settings. I felt it was really important to include that aspect also in this exhibit because it's in the Portland Chinatown Museum. So really, the kind of first model that you see is from a show called Uncle Hoda, Uncle Sam. And it was written by True Tron with Robert Egan and was done at ACT Theater back in 2010. And it's essentially about a young Vietnamese man's journey from his homeland in Vietnam to America, first Canada, and then the United States, and the kind of trauma and difficulties that he went through to get to the United States, and the difficulties that he had living in the United States.
Now, Gary, I have seen a lot of set models. I'm looking at each one of these models, and they are so intricate. Did you do more work for the exhibit, or is this what you normally do?
This is what I normally do.
I mean, there's so many layers to this, and it's almost like a dollhouse.
Yeah, it is. And I think the thing that people need to know about these models is the fact that the more specific you are as a designer, the more specific the model is, the better everybody on the production team and the producer and the director and the technical director are going to understand what you want in the show. And so these models are a kind of standard for the industry, I think. For the companies that I work for, they demand this kind of detail and this kind of...
How many? This must have taken you, what, 40 hours, 50 hours?
Oh, no, they take a lot of time to do, you know.
Well, more than that.
Oh, they do. They do. I mean, I think a lot of these shows often take weeks to build the model. And usually I'm working on a number of shows at the same time. So the models are in different states of preparation or execution or finish. And I do sometimes use assistants to work on shows for me, which is how I'm able to generate a number of shows at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot involved in this. Did you, as a young kid, did you used to do like paper airplanes and ships in a bottle or anything like that?
No, I never did things like that. And I did do fun houses in our garage, where I would subject other neighborhood kids to things like falling potato chip boxes and, you know, kind of try to scare them and everything. But no, I never did models as a child, really. I didn't have the patience for like making cars or putting together things that were really complicated.
Well, would you describe this and then we're going to move on to the other ones?
This particular model for Uncle Hoda, Uncle Sam, it happened in an in the round stage. The idea is that we wanted to kind of create more of a thrust situation so that the audience could sit on three sides and they were looking at, you know, kind of the same scenic environment. So we essentially built the set over a part of the seating area to turn it into a kind of a space that this actor, this single actor, could inhabit and tell the story of his life and his family and everything like that. And there are a lot of shutters and doors that are kind of hanging that on which projections were done so that as he told his story, it changed. But it's essentially kind of an altar. It's an altar to the family. It's a family altar. So there are pictures of people who have passed, and especially to his father, who was abusive. And then also a shrine to a sea goddess that figures prominently in Chinese lore. And we chose this sea goddess because she's venerated by people in China and in the Chinese diaspora as someone who will give safe passage across the seas, which is something that this young man was really hopeful about in escaping Vietnam and going to America.
Well, we'll have some photos on the website for people to reference
too.
So what's the next exhibit?
There's a cluster here of three sets from the Seattle Children's Theater. And I wanted to include them because I've done a lot of work for the company and wanted to show the kind of variety of things that we created and the specificity and detail and quality of the work that theater for young audiences can generate. These were all made under Linda Hartzell when she was the artistic director there. She had very high production values and standards. So we did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a musical version. And then we did Sleeping Beauty, which was a new version with songs written by Chad Henry. And then we did another piece that was a world premiere that Robert Schenken wrote for the company called A Single Shard. And it was set in 12th century Korea about celadon potters. Celadon was evidently invented by the Koreans. And in 12th century Korea, they were known for the best celadon glazes in the world.
So in the single shard, there are brush paintings, I assume, that were painted rather than projections.
Yes. So these particular panels were based on three very famous Korean paintings of the period. We wanted them to be able to define the space, but also to glow. So there were huge light boxes that were on tracks so that they could move and kind of reveal and hide certain things as the show progressed.
You know, I noticed this in looking at your website, too, that you have very Asian influences, even though it's Sleeping Beauty, even though it's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Would you speak to that? Because they're so beautiful, and they are still very fable-esque. But I can see in the artwork that it really feels Asian to me.
That's interesting. I think everybody has an aesthetic that comes out, whether it's conscious or unconscious. One thing that I really like in the work that I do is both architecture and shape, and also that idea of looking through things to see other things, which I think is a certain aspect of Chinese gardens. I mean, if you go to Lansu Chinese Garden and you walk through the garden, kind of every point at which you look reveals something new.
Well, I want to point out specifically in The Lion, the Witch, the Wardrobe, too, because you have, they're not panels, they're flats, but they are,
yeah,
they're almost like they're etched, you know? And I've seen that kind of leaf work, like in jewelry or Asian jewelry or like mm-hmm. paintings mm-hmm. with jade, you know?
One thing that we did for Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe was we took an Ansel Adams photograph and we played around with taking a detail of it and kind of putting it on the photocopier and doing negative, positive images of it and then overpainting on it. That's why it has a sort of etched graphic look with paint applied on top of it. And it proved to be a really successful technique for The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's a tough piece to do because people have to keep going back and forth between Narnia and war-torn England, and there's a lot of scenery involved.
Oh, I bet it was a beautiful production. Now, this is in your early 2000 periods.
Right.
Now, where are we going next?
Let's walk over to The Miser, first season of Portland Center Stage, when it was called Oregon Shakespeare Festival Portland.
Yeah, I worked there as an understudy for 2 years.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So I thought it would be apt to include this model, which is a kind of a big rotunda, very decorative and ornate for The Miser. The Miser in this rotunda has only a single chair. And if other people want to sit down when they visit him, they have to bring in their own chairs because he's a miser. But it was a really fun project to work on with Dennis Bigelow, who was mm-hmm. the first artistic director at Portland Center Stage, and actually going to return to Portland Center Stage next season to do a show.
Oh, which one?
Ms. Holmes and Miss Watson that Marissa Wolfe is directing.
Yes. And you just did Merry Wives of Windsor at Portland State University, too.
Yeah. I mean, I've had a good relationship with Portland State's opera program. So I occasionally do designs for them.
Well, now where do we go?
Well, let's walk over here. These two shows are from the Seattle Repertory Theater. One is Boeing Boeing, which I included this because it was like really a fun 60s show with a kind of another kind of rotunda-like set, but it has a really 60s vibe.
Yeah, very Mad Men.
Yeah, very Mad Men. Yeah. You know, kind of farces always have doors. So, you know, kind of the big thing about Boeing Boeing is you have to have 7 or 8 doors.
Yeah, there's like, what, 6?
Yeah, 6 and then an entry door, too.
Oh, yeah,
so 7 doors, yeah.
Yeah, you have to have doors opening and closing.
Doors.
Yeah.
And then the other one over here is The Importance of Being Earnest. And it was a show that we were really excited about doing because the director wanted to reset it to the 1930s.
That's good. I could see that happening.
Yeah. And so it was a very elaborate set. It was designed so that it only needed one intermission, so we could go from Act 2 to Act 3 in an open scene change. But then COVID hit, so it was canceled due to COVID.
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
Madam,
oh, I love this.
Madam Butterfly.
I hate the play. I hate the opera, you mm-hmm, know, but mm-hmm. this is a beautiful design.
Well, thanks. I'm, you know, kind of Butterfly these days can be a really problematic show to do. Part of it is, you know, kind of questions of cultural appropriation. And then also kind of yellow phase.
It is not kind of, unless they, they cast it all Asian. It is yellow phase. But back then in 1999,
it was, these issues were
not. You just put up with it because you just wanted work.
You just wanted work. So kind of the idea of this one was that, it's supposed to be pretty, but a lot of Japanese elements are incorrectly used. So the drop that you see at the back, which is based on a Japanese woodblock print, is upside down.
Oh, no.
But it still works. It still
was
works.
Was that purposely done?
It was purposely done. Yeah. And the torii gate is adjacent to a home, which doesn't really make sense. Torii gates are always entrances to sacred places. And this is far from a sacred place.
It's like you're commenting on the play.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of like there are incorrect uses of things which are intentional, because it kind of emphasizes the Western misunderstanding of a culture that they come to.
That is so subtle. I bet nobody got that, Karen.
I don't think people got it.
Yeah.
No.
That's kind of subversive what you did.
Right. Just trying to kind of sneak something in there.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. That was really clever of you.
There are two models kind of towards the back of the museum, if you go towards the restrooms, and they're for people to play with, so they can move around.
I directed that play. It got closed down in mid-run at Oregon Children's Theater, Ben Uchida. Yeah. I loved your design. It was beautiful.
I love that play.
Yeah.
So anyway, they can play around with these models. They're invited to, and kind of move the pieces around to make their own sets. So it's the Journal of Ben Uchida, and then also Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet.
Oh, yeah, Jamie. I love Jamie.
Yeah, Jamie Ford's.
Yeah.
This turned out to be a really successful adaptation.
So Book It Repertory really did sets and stuff. I thought it was performing the book, but...
No, they always do adaptations that are then staged.
And they just basically do the entire text of the book.
Right.
Or most of it.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they... try to
edit it down,
right.
This is amazing. It's all black and white, and it's very historical, and you've got historical photos of the actual Seattle.
We worked a lot with the Wing Luke Museum and went to their photo archives, and were able to get images of buildings and environments from Seattle's International District of the time that we wanted, so that there is a kind of a sense of historical authenticity to it.
What I loved about Jamie Ford's book is that it presented both a Chinese and Japanese love story with these young kids, but it also presented what the Chinese were doing at the time of the incarceration during World War II, which is not necessarily good.
Right, right. I really enjoyed working on this project. I wish it were done more, this particular show.
Wow. I'll ask Jamie for a Portland
Jamie.
Version.
Right.
So let's...
And there are a couple of more models that are in the ancillary conference room.
Okay, we're walking down
the
hall.
We're walking towards it, back where we kind of started a little bit. And if we keep going, there are four more. And the models that are in the conference room, let's walk over here. A Little Night Music was done for Wildwood Park in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Opera theater?
Opera theater.
So was it outdoors?
No, it was indoors.
Oh, okay.
But it was in and this was the inaugural production for the new theater.
And this was 1996.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a big thrust. So the audience sat on three sides. So we decided to do A Little Night Music on a turntable and create a miniature kind of Swedish old town in the middle of the stage. It worked more or less for the show. It was something that kind of gave us a sense of city. And then when we went to the country, we were able to replace the cluster of buildings in the center of the stage with a cluster of birch trees.
Oh, it's lovely.
So it kind of worked as an idea for the show.
When you start a concept, I mean, you obviously talk with the director and then you figure out what your budget is. But when you get a play, where do you start?
You do start with the director. I mean, that's kind of the important thing. The director is really the person to kind of guide the thinking and guide the direction of the show. And sometimes they have really strong ideas about a show. Sometimes they don't have clear ideas. And then your job is to help clarify things for them. And then you just start doing research and you bring in pictures and you look at research ideas or suggest thoughts, and it all kind of coalesces into something.
It's so collaborative, isn't it?
Yeah. The oldest model in the show is from Portland Opera. It was appropriate to have something for Portland Opera because that's where I started.
That's Don Giovanni, 1980. That's when you started doing set design?
I started doing set design in 74. But the Don Giovanni is one of the sets that I'm kind of happiest about from the 12 shows that I did while I was at Portland Opera. A British director, Malcolm Fraser, wanted to set Don Giovanni on the Day of the Dead. And at that time, in 1980, the Day of the Dead wasn't really well known like it is now as a celebration from Latin America, especially Mexico. And his idea was that there would be a single Spanish colonial facade with shutters and doors and things like that, that would, as the show went on, gradually be revealed to be a mausoleum where there were mummies in niches.
I was going to say that because it does look like it's a mausoleum.
Yeah. And that allowed the commendatore who gets killed in the first scene to become a mummy in a niche rather than an equestrian statue. And we looked a lot at, you know, that famous Museum of the Mummies in Guanajuato and used that as kind of the inspiration for the show. So the whole Spanish colonial facade becomes this mausoleum with a lot of religious symbolism and effigies and things in it.
It's both creepy and beautiful.
That is so much of, in some ways, the kind of Latin Catholic sensibility in a way. And so we really wanted to capture that.
Let's go to your next one.
Yeah, the last two shows are a...
Now, this is more bare bones here.
Right.
Going to St. Ives, 1997 at ACT Theater.
Right, and Going to St. Ives was an interesting piece because it was about an African mother who comes to a British physician to have her eyes looked at. She's having problems with vision. But the real reason why she's come is to get poison so that she can go back to Africa and poison her son, who is a dictator, a despot. And so it becomes a moral question of, is this something that can ethically be done? You know, is it ethical to kill one person in order to save many people? And obviously, a mother killing her son is what kind of almost like Greek tragedy in a way. So we really felt that we wanted the set to show that kind of primal problem, that the earth is groaning or breaking apart just because of this act of that seems so just against the grain.
So it almost looks like the aftermath of an earthquake.
Yeah. And so that's what this is. It's a set that has kind of the gaps in the earth showing. But in the first act, it's a kind of morning room of the physician. So it has a wooden floor and furniture, and it's very pristine. And during the intermission, all of that is moved away to show the crevices and cracks in the floor that's underneath this kind of very civilized world.
What does it feel like for you to see all of your work presented in three dimensions here?
It's been really exciting. It's kind of like a trip down memory lane in a way. Kind of the last show is a magic flute, and the model is still being kind of refurbished. And it was originally done for Orlando Opera, and then it ended up being shared with Beijing and Macau music festivals. So this actually went to Asia, and it was kind of based on Asian motifs again, certain kind of shapes and colors and topographies.
I have to ask you, you started in the 70s, right? And it probably straight out of, did you go to design school?
Yeah, I went to Yale in my undergraduate, and then I went to Yale Drama. But I didn't finish at Yale Drama. I felt that I didn't have enough experience. So that's how I came to Portland Opera. I think Portland Opera was kind of, for me, graduate school.
When did you go to Seattle?
I moved up to Seattle in 1988. My spouse got tenure at Pacific Lutheran University, where he taught English for many years. So once he got tenure, I decided to move up to Seattle.
Well, but you're still connected here.
I am.
I'm wondering, that time period in theater and in opera, you must have been one of the few, if not the only, BIPOC scenic designer in this area.
I could very well have been. I mean, there are more of us now, but there are not a lot of us. I think that's the challenge of theater, is that it's so important to get more BIPOC people involved in it. I think a lot of Asian parents are very intent on moving their children towards professions that are more lucrative, like being a lawyer or a doctor or an engineer. You know how that is.
I smile because, yes, of course, that is the tradition, which leads me to my next question. Did your parents ever understand your work as a scenic designer? Were they proud of it? Did they, you know?
I think my mom really understood it, and she always really encouraged me to kind of just follow what I was interested in. You know, I was one of those kids that was lucky in a way because I had no pressure put on me academically or kind of profession-wise, at least from her. My dad, you know, really wanted me to go to a different school, and he wanted me to go into a different profession. Your parents just worry about whether you're going to be happy and whether you're going to be able to support yourself. And so I think his concerns were more practical than kind of prescriptive. And I think he's very proud now that I've been able to make a profession of it. But there were many years where he was highly dubious.
Well, I'm sure he's very proud now. Yeah. And, you know, getting back to being one of the few BIPOC designers, did you ever feel, I know what it's like to be like the only person in the room, you know, and I'm wondering, did you ever feel like you had to voice things that were uncomfortable for you?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, part of it is you're never in a room where the people are talking about who to hire for a job. So you don't know, first of all, often how you got the job or what the criteria were for hiring you. And, you know, I think one good thing about the arts, at least that I found in the experiences that I've had, is that I was never made to feel uncomfortable as the sole minority person on a creative team. And often I was working on shows that were kind of non-Asian themed often. So I was kind of working on things that wouldn't bring up race or ethnicity at all. I feel very lucky that I was in a situation where I wasn't made to feel uncomfortable or that it was problematic for me to work.
You mentioned that you might have assistants when you work now. Do you feel like you are mentoring the next generation ever?
Oh, I do. I mean, this year I've been teaching at the University of Washington in their Graduate School of Drama. And I'm completing this year. I was just kind of a one-year replacement for someone. The assistants that I've had are often people who have gone on to be scenic designers themselves. I'm really trying to find assistants who are BIPOC or underrepresented other people, kinds of people, to work with so that they can have an opportunity to kind of move into the profession. And I feel really fortunate to be able to kind of be in the Seattle area where there are a lot of talented and interested young people.
So if I hear of somebody who's looking to be mentored and to work as an assistant, I can send them your way?
Yes, please do, Dimay, because I mean, I'm doing frequent or fairly often shows in Portland.
You're very busy, too.
I'm kind of busy.
And what's nice about scenic design, too, is that you could go up to Seattle to do a work and can come back to Portland. I mean, you've been doing it.
I mean, the thing about being a designer is that most of your work is done at home. And then you only really have to be on site, aside from meetings, which can be on Zoom. You only have to be on site once you're in technical rehearsals, you know, and final previews and things like that.
Okay, so this is for all the young listeners who are looking for work right now. You heard it here on Stage and Studio on Arts Watch. You know, I'm so glad that you had this. You really deserve it. You are a veteran artist, designer, yes, but a veteran artist. And it shows so much in the work that you're presenting here with the models and the representations and the photos. I'm wondering, what's your next steps?
That's a good question.
Oh, you say everything is a good question.
Yeah, that's a good, you're a good interviewer. The thing is, I keep trying to kind of slowly ease myself out of the profession because I'm at an age where, you know, a lot of people that I know are retired or are in semi-retirement. So my next step is trying to kind of keep my hand in doing this, but not be so busy that I don't have time to just enjoy life. And that's hard because, you know, there are always tempting offers. Either the shows are interesting or you want to work with people that are colleagues of yours that you enjoy working with, or, you know, kind of just other things. So, I mean, I have a feeling I'm going to be pretty busy for the next couple of years and then kind of like slowly try to back away.
So your next show that you're going to be in Portland is Portland Center Stage.
Yeah, the next show on my list is Portland Center Stage.
When is that?
It's in January.
Oh, so it's coming up.
All of my shows next year start in January. So yeah, Ms. Holmes and Ms. Watson is going to be the next show.
Carrie Wong, it's just been a pleasure to take this retrospective of your magnificent work here at the Portland Chinatown Museum. Congratulations on this.
Oh, thanks, Dimei. And thanks for letting us talk about it today. I really appreciate it.
I talk with veteran designer Carrie Wong on location at the Portland Chinatown Museum. The World Transformed, an exhibit of 16 of his designs and models, will be on view through September 10th. More info and photos of Wong's designs at stageandstudio.org or orartswatch.org. Till the next conversation, I'm Dimei Lo Roberts.